For me, this is not symbolism. This is a statement and an action in the right direction that pulls back something that was ripped away from us in the passage of HB 2.
The latest chapter in the House Bill 2 saga brings our attention back to the municipalities. I'm Jeff Tabiri. This is the Politics Podcast from WUNC. Today on the pod, non-discrimination ordinances, NDOs, why they're happening now, what the legislature might do, and their impact, both symbolically and literally. First, some background, then some perspective. I know you know all about House Bill 2. It's the controversial and divisive state law that was passed in 2016 and partially repealed in 2017, after it cost North Carolina billions of dollars and left a stain on our reputation. The bathroom bill, as it was known, actually included several controversial components, the most notable of which prevented transgender people from using public restrooms that corresponded with their gender identity. At the heart of the issue was a power struggle between state and local governments over who had ultimate control over anti-discrimination ordinances.
All those in favor, raise your hand. And all those opposed. Okay, so we have that passing 7-4, and thank you very much.
Remember, prior to the passage of HB 2, the Charlotte City Council approved an ordinance extending protections to the LGBTQ community. And that set the whole thing off. When the legislature rolled back parts of House Bill 2 in 2017, it included a provision barring municipalities from passing future non-discrimination ordinances. That ban expired at the end of December. And in recent weeks, municipalities across the state have approved non-discrimination ordinances aimed at, among other things, protecting the employment status of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer, LGBTQ, people.
Bottom line is HB 2 has reached a sunset, and we have got to put something on the books tonight that is in place to protect the LGBTQ community.
Greensboro, along with Hillsboro, Carrboro, Chapel Hill, Durham, and Mecklenburg and Orange counties, have recently backed progressive ordinances and resolutions. Other cities are expected to soon follow suit.
Speaking as the sole LGBTQ member of this group, these are the most basic protections, and I want them to be expanded to the fullest extent that they possibly can.
Michelle Kennedy is a Greensboro City Council member. She's openly gay.
We know that, to be frank, we were targeted by the legislature for a lot of these protections, and that we likely will be again. And so for me, as a member of the LGBTQ community, it's important to me that we go as full as we can without going to the point that we're going to have everything cut out from underneath us and end up back with nothing. So I'm trying to find that middle ground.
One subplot to these ordinances has been whether to and how to give them teeth. These ordinances could range from no consequence to charging people in violation with a misdemeanor. In Greensboro, the initial ordinance did not include any punishment. After lengthy debate last month, city council members opted for a middle ground, a $500 penalty. Again, Kennedy speaking during that meeting in January.
My concern around that is because we watched HB 2 rip us of the protections we already had in place. And we know that that is possible to happen again. And so I want to make absolutely sure that whatever we enact is not going to get, you know, clear cut by the state legislature as soon as we enact it.
But it doesn't look like any of these ordinances are going to get upended anytime soon.
I don't think that anything is going to be done in 2021 at the state level.
Allison Dahl is a Democrat in the North Carolina House. Her party is in the minority and simply lacks the strength to pass a statewide non-discrimination bill. But leading Republicans presently have little, if any, interest in renewing this dispute. The first go-round was an economic and public relations disaster, and it contributed to then-Governor Pat McCrory losing his post. Also, the threat of a veto from now Governor Roy Cooper is likely to table any legislation. Representative Dahl is from Wake County. She's a lesbian who says she doesn't face constant discrimination, and adds that in an ideal world, we could collectively move on from this conversation. Dahl is planning to file a bill banning conversion therapy in North Carolina, which remains legal. But realistically, we're not there yet.
They are necessary, probably largely more for those people who are transgendered, because they have probably received more outward aggression or more outward discrimination. Being a lesbian, being married to my wife, nobody really thinks twice about two girls walking arm in arm. And so I think the NDOs are really important for that fact, because everybody needs to feel valued.
What is noticeably different now versus 10 years ago here in the South is how overt discrimination has become.
Candace Cox lives in Charlotte. She serves on the executive board of Equality NC and is an LGBTQ plus activist and educator.
I'm a North Carolinian. I am a Democrat. I'm a daughter. I'm Catholic. I am civic-minded. The things that I use to define myself would not be any of the, you know, trans or black. But, you know, none of the things that I think stand out the most, the things that define me are, I'm just a person trying to make it.
I want to ask you about these NDOs writ large, and I want to get at both the symbolism of them and the literal impact of them. Let's start with the symbolism of them. But as you've seen, as you've read, as you've heard about these gaining approval in Greensboro and Hillsboro and Raleigh and Carrboro, and I know that I'm not listing all of them, but a number of places across the state, symbolically, how have you greeted that news?
In a post-HB2 world, I think it's just really... It's wonderful fodder for news headlines, you know, and it really does. It makes you look great, you know, as a city or as a municipality. But beyond that, I think it is insulting almost.
So you say it looks great. It's great fodder for news headlines. Hammer that down for me a little bit. Let me play devil's advocate and say, well, there's got to be a first step, right? Like, we just had this chapter of HB2. The state lost billions of dollars. It was this reminder of discrimination. This they bungled the whole thing, state lawmakers. But to try to undo some of that, to try to improve, doesn't there have to be a first step, even if small and symbolic?
I think that if we were talking about social change, absolutely, then we would certainly be talking about there being a first step. But what we are talking about is putting in place protections for our citizens, which the fact that we do not is such in, you know, strong opposition to our Constitution as it is, you know. So it's like, no, we don't really have room for baby steps. And more notably, this isn't something that is very complicated. Like, this isn't super hard to figure out. I think it is easier to say, you know, oh, look, what we as a liberal or, you know, Democratic majority were able to pass, we're not going to discriminate against LGBTQ plus people in employment practices with the city. And that's great. But I'm like, okay, I'm a trans person. I know a lot of people here. How many people are you protecting? You know, and the problems that people are facing, you're not actually addressing in your ordinances. So
to that point, my understanding, at least of the Greensboro one, is it's not just city employees. It's everyone. It's if a small business owner discriminates against somebody based on LGBTQ+, they are subject to a $500 fine. In Durham, there are some other provisions, but if you don't pay the fine, you're subject to a misdemeanor, just for clarity or for clarification. But the bigger picture here is, if this is fodder for news headlines, as you say, and there are bigger things to do, what should they be doing? What should these ordinances really be crafted around, and how can they truly make more of a social change, a social difference?
It's wonderful if all who are doing business in the city of Charlotte, but if you are fired for, you know, some awful reason, and one, used to live in a state that is a right-to-work state, that means that proving discrimination is very difficult as is. Secondly, when you go apply for unemployment, the Unemployment Security Commission in North Carolina is not administered by the city of Greensboro. It's going to be through your county. So Guilford County would actually have to be the ones to pass these measures. And those measures are only going to be protected if the General Assembly actually says, hey, here's, you know, what we have to look at, and here's how people can challenge discrimination and employment practices. So that's the change that needs to happen, is we need to make it so that people can actually challenge the system and have some kind of safety measures in place. And that's the change that we could do first and foremost. If people have hangups on LGBTQ+ and they can't get past it, great. Then why don't you at least do your civic duty as an elected official and make it easier for all North Carolinians, not just LGBTQ+, all North Carolinians, to have better safety measures and backup systems in place, so that if they do feel as though they have been unjustly discriminated against, they have some kind of recourse.
My name is Brandon Cartagena. I am 26 years old, and this is my second year teaching in Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools and my fifth year in the profession.
Originally from Tennessee, Brandon is celebrating the recent ordinances in his community.
People outside of our region have their misconceptions of what it must be like to live here and what it must like to be queer here. In fact, many, including myself, would argue that a lot of queer individuals have been erased from Southern discourse and Southern narratives. So to see Southern queer folks achieving these victories is significant, and I think it's deeply poetic, and I hope more and more people will consider the beauty of that.
For Brandon, the impact of these ordinances is rooted in respecting and showing his authentic self.
Well, I think when you are a teacher, in addition to working with your students and working with your parents, you're also somewhat of a public figure. So there's that need to sort of protect yourself in the public eye. And there's always a constant fear of, you know, you really, really enjoy the students you work with, you really enjoy the students and their parents, but deep down inside, you don't know what the community at its heart really feels. You don't know how certain people will react to certain aspects of your life. And while being a gay person, an openly gay person, is not ethically anything wrong, there was always that constant fear of, what if somebody finds out and this becomes an issue? What will the administration do at my school? What can they do? And it's a frightening experience. I think it leads to a lot of internalized shame, and it leads to this feeling of constantly sort of tracking what you're doing and making sure you're not revealing too much.
The extent to which you had to hide that authentic self, I hesitate to use the word conceal because I think there's a negative connotation with that word, but what did you feel you had to do, or what did you do to kind of protect some of those personal details earlier on in your teaching career?
That's a great question. And I think the first word that pops up into my mind is constant deflection. And that's something that was very difficult for me to do. I remember a very particular instance in Tennessee, particularly, and it easily could have happened in North Carolina as well. But I remember a time where I went to a festival with my then partner. This was a festival celebrating Hispanic culture and Hispanic heritage. So I was there, many of my students were there, and they saw me with this person. And I think many of the students that saw me with this person probably gathered that there was a romantic connection between us, which there was. And most of them probably would have been extremely supportive and happy to know this. So the Monday returning to school after this this weekend festival, a lot of the students that were there in front of the class asked me who this person was, just out of a genuine and innocent curiosity. And I had to deflect and say, okay, we're just going to talk about the academics for the day. We're just going to go straight into the academics and not have a conversation that for maybe a straight teacher would be normal and special and exciting. And it was a little bit hurtful. And it was a sort of constant battle of other situations similarly arising in which they would see me with this person and ask an innocent question, and then back to that mechanism of deflecting.
What are some of the words that you would use to describe this ordinance for you? I mean, is it freeing? Does it give you a sense of relief? Am I overstating it? The question is, how would you describe what this provides to you from a personal sense of place? How do you feel in response to it?
Right. I think the first word that comes to my mind is it's liberating. It makes me feel that I have the freedom to not have to deflect and not have to hide what my weekend plans were or avoid certain questions. And then I think the second word that comes to mind is protective. Because at the end of the day, I know that in my work environment, I work with mainly amazing supportive people and supportive students and supportive parents. But realistically, eventually I will come across someone who might not be as supportive. But what I know in the back of my head is that the local government will be supportive. The county government will be supportive. So I feel protected and liberated at the same time.
So with this having just transpired, this moved forward, what comes next? What would you like to see as the next step, whether that's from the Chapel Hill Town Council or the Orange County Commissioners or the state? What is there now that they've done this, which is a step forward, no doubt, but there's still many steps to take, I think. What more would you like to see? What next would you like to see?
You know, I think an LGBTQ issue that's particularly concerning to me are inequities in the health sector. And while to a certain degree that is protected or that is included in some of the LGBTQ protections, a lot of the inequities that we see are completely due to access and how that uniquely affects LGBTQ and particularly trans and particularly trans people of color. But, you know, I think on a more celebratory note, speaking specifically to these LGBTQ protections that have been passed in many municipalities, sort of the thing that I'm looking forward to and the sort of next steps that I'm very closely watching are the cultural implications. I think, as I said earlier, policy is communication. And with policy comes certain changes in culture. And I think what we could see at the local level is sort of inclusive LGBTQ friendly culture, and we can see that expand. And I think and hope that what that will bring is that eventually it won't be so necessary to pass laws, and people will just understand that to be LGBTQ is nothing wrong.
The NDOs across North Carolina have not just been limited to protections for LGBTQ people. Several municipalities, among them Greensboro, Durham, and Carrboro, have also included protections for hairstyles. The provisions ban discrimination based on hairstyle, texture, and type historically associated with race. This push from local governments is following the lead of the Crown Act, a national initiative to ban the discrimination of natural hair. The Crown Act passed in the U.S. House of Representatives last fall and now sits in the Senate. It's an ordinance that carries specific resonance for black women. Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry helped push for it in the Bull City.
There have been many people who have had conversations with me about my hair in a professional setting. I don't think that there is any black woman who is in a professional setting, who is in any setting, quite frankly, who will tell you that she has not had several of the same conversations about her hair.
DeBerry says protecting natural hairstyles has been a long time coming. She shared with me a personal experience from more than 20 years ago during her early days in the courtroom.
This is a radio program, so you can't see that I do wear my hair naturally. This is the way that my hair grows out of my head. I don't do anything special to it, no chemicals. And, you know, I wear my hair natural, one, because it is easier for me in the way that I feel most confident. You know, I've been now practicing law for over 25 years. And when I first started practicing law, I had started practicing in D.C., and black women had started to wear their hair natural there, so I was wearing my hair natural. Then I moved back to North Carolina, and I was in a trial representing someone, and the clerk of court in the courtroom called me over during a break and said to me, I might want to think about how I was wearing my hair. She said, you know, I know you've just been in D.C., and things are different there, but down here, people are going to think the way you wear your hair says something about you, and you don't want to put your client in a bad light.
Which is fascinating, and I'm going to unpack it, hopefully not in a dangerous way. And I guess the intentions don't matter at all on some level. But I wonder, was that clerk of court looking out for you and looking out for the best interests of your client? Was that an overtly racist statement? Of course, those things are not mutually exclusive. It could have been both. Did that speak to more of an ignorance, a lack of acceptance, or just how things still were in North Carolina, and that it might behoove you to go about it that way? Like, what was her message as you heard it in that moment?
Yeah, that I think she definitely thought she was looking out for me. She was also a black woman. She was somebody who'd known me growing up. I think she took pride in that I was in the courtroom, and she wanted me to be successful. And this is the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, so we're not talking terribly long ago. But, you know, she just felt that natural hair was not going to be perceived as being professional.
So tell me for this one, why now? Why was it time for you all to act and to put this into a city ordinance?
Well, it's always time for you to show up as your authentic self. So that's the first thing I would say. And it should always be time for you not to be discriminated against when you do that. But these, you know, more specifically, we've seen the real impact, especially of black women in this last election cycle, of using their political power to make things more equal and more fair. And it seemed like we had an opportunity really to create something lasting around that momentum.
Like the more broad non-discrimination ordinances, DeBerry says the hairstyle protection has not received much pushback from officials at the state or local level.
I think it is, you know, a testament to the times that we live in and the broader understanding of not just kind of what I need as a black woman to be comfortable and successful in the workplace, but how certainly that also allows you, and I don't want to assume, but you as a white man to also be successful in yourself and show up in your full identity in the workplace. And so I think there's broader understanding of that.
Meanwhile, earlier this month, the Durham City Council also passed a resolution urging state and federal legislators to approve the Crown Act. As always, glad to have you along for the WUNC Politics Podcast. Big thanks to Charlie Shelton Ormond and Anita Rao, who helped with this episode. And a reminder, join us on Friday. Clark Reamer and Aisha Du will gather around to review some of what happened this week in North Carolina politics. That, of course, includes the censure of one prominent Republican. Until then, make sure you go snag those latest episodes of Tested and Embodied. My name is Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your week.